Folks, it's almost really become a full-time job to stay on top of and in front of the mixed messaging relative to what the regime is saying in Iran and where we are in our position from the U.S. perspective, a ceasefire, diplomatic negotiations, trying to negotiate a memorandum of understanding, not really sure what that ultimately means and what the final document is going to look like. And Jonathan Saieh joins us, Iran analyst with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Jonathan, you've been following this religiously every day. I don't know about you, but this, for me, this is getting harder and harder to wrap my head around where we are and why.
Hi, it's great to be with you, and you're right to point that out. Having covered this as long as I have, it does get more complex, but similar themes are reemerging in a sense that when discussing the big picture between Tehran and Washington, you seem to get some positive remarks coming from the two sides. But as soon as it's about the detail and the sequencing, more importantly, we see the clash. So right now, I think the biggest hurdle is who's going to provide the concessions first. Will the United States release some frozen assets, and then in return, Tehran would show a similar gesture? Or are we waiting for Tehran to make the first move so we know we're negotiating in good faith, and then we can maybe, in theory, reward them with unfreezing a certain amount of their assets? But nonetheless, the discussions right now are limited to an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, so we're still quite far from an actual deal.
Are they worthy, in your view, of getting the concessions first? I mean, they have a long history of misdirection, leveraging, misleading, and I'll just say it, lying.
Lying is the most precise term, as you noted, and I think everything really shattered in 2015 when we enacted a deal, and on paper there were supposed to be full inspections, and then we found out there are undeclared locations where they were enriching uranium, and that misleading really policy has been going on. Of course, deception is Tehran's main strategy. That's one hand, and two is where these funds are going to end up. Let's even say we play this game with the Islamic Republic, and let's say we somehow want to appease them. The challenge there is we know those funds are going to, again, attack our bases, our forces, and our allies in the region, because one thing about the Islamic Republic, having grown up there and having been jailed in the Islamic Republic's prison system, I can tell you that the welfare of their own people has never been on the agenda, let alone a priority. So it's one, getting it to them is one challenge, and then what they're going to do with those billions is, of course, the main concern now.
So in the meantime, over the last 48 to 72 hours, we have what seems to be, although we're not characterizing it that way, that we've reengaged kinetically, right?
You can say that. I guess a better description of the status is the fire never ceased. I guess there was never quite a ceasefire. We saw the war wind down, but to see the Islamic Republic to still be this emboldened and actually launch attacks against our assets is indicative of their mindset, meaning they thought they won this war. And that is nothing short of an ideological regime that, of course, any pause in attacks against this infrastructure is somehow a victory to them. And what we've seen so far is that they do not change their behavior, no matter if it's during a conflict, pre or post. But you're right to point out that the kinetic engagement is ongoing, and of course we see the instigation always be initiated by the Islamic Republic, and of course we're just simply responding to the aggression.
We're visiting with Jonathan Saieh, Iran analyst, with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. One of their strategies has been to bring the region into this, and they have sought and sent ballistic missiles, drones, and other armaments into the neighboring countries, I guess in the hopes of trying to create a fracture with this alliance with the U.S. Have they succeeded at all in that regard?
In certain ways, you can perhaps make the case, but in the big picture, no. So one thing that really stood out to many of us is despite Iran attacking NATO countries, and in this case we talk about Turkey or the or Cyprus in this case, UK bases there, we did not see any response come from Europe. So that was really astonishing. Unfortunately, maybe not that surprising given the history of appeasement coming from that continent for the Islamic Republic. And even when the regime blocked the Strait of Hormuz, Europeans were the first to pay the price. And again, we saw nothing but appeasement from them. So maybe that might be more point of a friction between Washington and the EU as a whole, especially given how much involvement we had in the war in Ukraine. But whereas it's their turn to, I guess, help us out, we see that lack of desire. But on the other hand, when you look at the regional Arab states, we see a closer coordination between them and Israel. So if there's any example for us to see why the Abraham Accords had to be done when they did, and actually we see them expand, it is in fact the Islamic Republic's aggressive policies towards the Persian Gulf Arab neighbors that is getting them closer in coordination with Israel. So that was ended up being a one really for having a regional coalition against the regime.
So when we refer to the regime, the other thing that kind of mystifies me is who is the regime? Do we know, really?
That's an excellent question. Of course, it's not a one-man show like Libya's Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's not just one Ayatollah. There are different pillars. You can maybe categorize them in two different themes. One of them is the pillars that are tasked with waging war, continuing this conflict, regionalizing it, and inflicting costs on the United States. That is primarily the IRGC, the main body of the military apparatus. And the other theme is internal. So whatever asset can crack down on Iranians' dissidents inside the judiciary, the law enforcement, perhaps the clergy. So what you see right now when we talk about a regime is whatever pillars that could ensure the survival of the system that's in place. And they think their survival depends on cracking down internally and waging war externally.
So if we were to have to re-engage kinetically, you know, full force, where would they go? What would they do? I mean, you know, we've bombed them pretty much into oblivion for the most part. Would we attack kinetically that internal pillar that you're talking about? Because it seems as though that's where we would get the most juice for the squeeze.
We precisely would. The way to characterize it is the regime thinks it can absorb another round of attacks if it's external bombings. So the question is not the scale of a renewed campaign, is more so the targeting of it. The president was recently announced, President Trump, that he was very clear that he did not go after the body of the armed apparatus. He went after certain individuals of leadership. Whereas you saw the Israeli campaign go after the repression apparatus, it's ultimately about emboldening the main threat against the regime. And that is not bombs, that's the Iranian people. So any campaign that would somehow aid them, talk to them, of course it needs to be on one hand public diplomacy to encourage dissidents to go out and then backing them up, whether it's going to be the drones or actually equipping them with better capabilities to confront the repressors. But should there be a new round of engagement, at least overtly, it's really about shifting our focus and our target, and we should really pivot away from any remarks or suggestions of regime change having already been in place. The individuals that are in charge right now have been part of the regime's apparatus for a while. It's really about messaging that the end is officially near and we are looking at somehow having a systemic transition of power into Tehran.
And, I mean, you've been there. You're familiar with the culture. Is that truly long-term achievable?
More than any other country, I think what really concerns, I guess, Americans as a whole, and of course DC's policymakers, is the legacy of Iraq or Afghanistan. But the context in Iran is fundamentally different in a sense that, one, it's very populated. Iran is one of the most educated countries in the region, per capita especially. You have a very strong women's rights movement, something you didn't have in Iraq or Afghanistan. You have a population that is inherently anti-Islamist, and that's key. So when we were dealing with kinetic operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan after overthrowing the regime that was in charge, we were dealing with Islamists because that was the only other force. But right now in Iran, the Islamists are in charge. So overthrowing them simply means we're giving way for the secular, pro-democracy, pro-American population to rise up. And, you know, talking to young Iranians as long as I do, I was born in the 90s personally, so talking to millennials, talking to Gen Z, they've been exposed to the internet. This is not the Cold War era than when we attacked, let's say, Iraq. This is a new wave. The generations that have seen the life in the West, have seen America, and they risked their lives in the tens of thousands to achieve these simple freedoms. So we know where the society is headed. It's a matter of aiding that movement or suppressing it.
So going dark technologically and defeating that and pushing that back would be a huge upside in the short term then, right?
Technologically, in the sense of internet, do you mean?
Yes, sir.
Correct. So the challenge with the internet is you need to have a two-pillar strategy. On one hand, you want to aid Iranians as much as you can with VPNs, with Starlink, with any internet circumvention tool. Parallel to that, it has to be degrading the regime's censorship capabilities, which a lot of it is getting imported from Beijing. So, of course, you have to confront the relationship between Iran and China that is the main architect behind the regime's repressive capabilities. So restoring any internet access in the short term, again, would be huge. It would be, have a major impact. But this is to say that internet is not the only asset here. There's right. also satellite dish channel. There's also radio. There's other ways to get information inside Iran. The main challenge is, one, getting information from Iran, and two, connecting Iranians to each other during times of crisis.
One of the things that's troubling me at this kind of crossroad where we find ourselves today is the insistence of the regime of the salvation of Hezbollah in Lebanon. How do you interpret what's going on there?
Let's look at Tehran's demands prior to the war. They were under the impression that maybe they might somehow get a deal that would mean they need to dismantle their nuclear program, and then they would get sanctions relief in return. Now you look at their demands, it's not even comparable to the pre-war. So you're talking about an ideological regime that is increasingly more paranoid and sees concessions as weakness, so they're going to maximize their demand. And in the particular case of Hezbollah, they are capitalizing on the president's eagerness to stabilize the region as a whole. They realize that the chokehold, the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab al-Mandeb that is controlled by the Houthis effectively, and Lebanon and the Levant, as a whole is creating this image of chaos, something that Trump wants to address. So the message from Tehran is rather more clear that now the stakes are much higher. We want significantly more reparations and incentives for stabilizing the region as a whole. They're trying to play into President Trump's instinct to really get something long-lasting in the Middle East. But again, this is nothing short of a regime that is miscalculating its hand. They're under the impression that they have more cards than they actually possess.
So diplomatically, When do you know enough is enough? I mean, I know you're always, you know, have that channel or the back channel open, but in an overt way, when does the president go to the podium and say, okay, we're done?
The president effectively did that prior to the war, which led to two rounds of attacks. So in June 2025, the 12-day war was because, one, the Islamic Republic did not negotiate in good faith. The president ordered the strikes, Operation Midnight Hammer. And then again, we saw that in February 28th. And now we're at the third stage where the president clearly noted that even if he does not get a deal, even if he sees that enough is enough, he will simply maintain the economic pressure on the Islamic Republic to the point of either collapse or concessions. So the blockade of Iran's ports is having a major impact on the regime's economy. And this reminds me of one of the tweets sent out by the president. I think it was before he was elected, when he noted that as part of the deal, it's important to know when to walk away from negotiations. And it seems like Trump is already entertaining that option. The real question is, what are the consequences for Tehran should we walk away from a deal? Are we simply going to maximize maximum pressure, pair that with maximum support for the Iranian people, or is there going to be a military campaign? Or are we going to authorize the Israelis to maybe conduct some covert operations? The options are there.
Right. It's going to be interesting, and it's changing by the moment. In fact, probably has already changed since you came on the show 20 minutes ago. So I'm almost, that's probably a better bet than Secretariat. But thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan Sayeh, Iran analyst with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Have a great week.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.